Chapter 15. Managing the Abstraction. Numbers of people aren't people, they're numbers. The death of one man is a tragedy, Joseph Stalin reportedly said. The death of a million is a statistic. Stalin was a man who well understood statistics. As General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union from 1922 to 1952, he is said to have been responsible for the deaths of millions of people, most of whom were Soviet citizens. Like so many dictator types, he had a cult of personality, operated with extreme brutality, trusted very few people, and was very, very paranoid. But he was also absolutely right about how we perceive a tragedy that befalls one person over that of hundreds, thousands, or even millions. Here are two stories to show you what I mean. Both stories are completely true. Story 1. When I wrote this book, the country of Syria was being torn apart by what was basically a civil war. Inspired by the Arab Spring that swept across the region, the Syrian people rose against the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, who took control of the country in 2000 when his father, Hafez al-Assad, died after 29 years of equally brutal rule. In over 40 years of Assad rule, two generations of Syrian men and women have known nothing else. This is a modern media world, however, and as much as the Syrian government tried to suppress news of uprising in neighboring nations, word of these rebellions made it through. But in stark contrast to the peaceful uprisings in Tunisia, the Syrian rebellion was met with extreme and intense brutality by the Assad government. World opinion did nothing to affect the Assad regime as it continued to pound a disorganized and ill-equipped rebellion with the full might of the army. United Nations estimates at the time of this book were that over 100,000 Syrians were killed by the Syrian military, including nearly 1,500 in a single chemical attack, a good many of them innocent civilians. Story 2. An 18-year-old girl was lying in the middle of the street in San Clemente, California. She'd been hit by a car driven by a 17-year-old girl. Unconscious, with one of her legs broken and pointing sideways at an unnatural angle, she was in bad shape. Cammy Yoder, an army reservist who happened to be driving past, pulled over to see if she could help. Kneeling down beside the injured woman, Cammy took her vitals. The girl wasn't breathing, and her pulse was faint at best. Immediately, Cammy began CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to try to keep the young woman alive. Not much later, an ambulance arrived, and the paramedics took over. They stabilized the young woman and took her to the hospital. A few days after the incident, Cammy wondered how the girl was faring. She was able to find the news story online and learned what had happened. She had died. This young woman, her whole life ahead of her, was gone. Which story evoked a stronger feeling? The first one or the second one? A story about tens of thousands of people struck down by their own military as they stood up for something noble does not have the same emotional impact on us as the story of one person does. We mourn the death of one young woman with an empathy that we are seemingly unable to muster for thousands of young women and children and others struck down as senselessly and even more brutally. This is one of the shortcomings of using numbers to represent people. At some point, the numbers lose their connection to the people and become just numbers, void of meaning. We are visually oriented animals. We can pursue things we can see. If it is a person in need, we can rush to their aid. If there is a clear vision of a future state brighter than our world today, we can work to build it. And if it is to advance a metric from one number to another, we can do that too. But when numbers are the only thing we can see, our ability to perceive the distant impact our decisions may have is frustrated. It's one thing for big numbers to represent money or products, but when big numbers start representing human beings, as Stalin told us, our ability to empathize starts to falter. If your sister, the major breadwinner in her family, loses her job, it will have a significant impact on the lives of your niece and nephew. And that loss would be a deep emotional burden on your sister, her family, and probably you too. But a decision made using a spreadsheet to lay off 4,000 people at some large corporation loses tangibility and becomes something that just needs to be done to meet certain goals. The numbers no longer represent people who support their families, but simply abstractions to be calculated. Be it a politician or someone working in a company, Perhaps the most valuable thing we can do, if we are to truly serve our constituents, is to know them personally. It would be impossible to know all of them, but to know the name and details of the life of someone we are trying to help with our product, service, or policy makes a huge difference. The moment we are able to make tangible that which had previously been a study or a chart, the moment a statistic or a poll becomes a real living person, the moment abstract concepts are understood to have human consequences is the moment our ability to solve problems and innovate becomes remarkable. Rule 1. Keep it real. Bring people together. As if the abstracting qualities of numbers and scale aren't enough to deal with when trying to run an organization, these days we have the added complication of the virtual world. The internet is nothing short of awe-inspiring. It gives the power to operate at scale or spread ideas to anyone, be it a small business or a social movement. It gives us the ability to find and connect with people more easily, and it is incredible at speeding the pace of commercial transactions. All of these things are good. But just as money was developed to help expedite and simplify transactions by allowing payment to be rendered without barter, we often use the internet as a means to expedite and simplify communication and the relationships we build. And just as money can't buy love, the internet can't buy deep, trusting relationships. What makes a statement like that somewhat tricky or controversial is that the relationships we form online feel real. We can, indeed, get bursts of serotonin when people like our pictures, pages, or posts, or when we watch ourselves go up in a ranking. You know how much serotonin loves a ranking. The feelings of admiration we get from virtual likes or the number of followers we have is not like the feelings of admiration we get from our children or that a coach gets from their players. It is simply a public display of like with no sacrifice required, a new kind of status symbol, if you will. Put simply, though the love may feel real, the relationship is still virtual. Relationships certainly can start online, but they only become real when we meet face to face. Consider the impact that Facebook and other online communications tools have had on teen bullying. 1/4 of all teenagers in the U.S. say they have experienced cyberbullying. What we've learned is that the abstractions can lead people to abhorrent behavior, to act like they're not accountable. An online community gives shy people a chance to be heard, but the flip side is it also allows someone to act out in ways they probably never would in real life. People say horrible things to each other online, things they probably would never say in person. The ability to maintain distance, even complete anonymity, has made it easier to stop acting as humans should, with humanity. And despite the positive feelings we can have when meeting people online, unlike real friendships based on love and trust, the feelings we get don't last long after we've logged off, and they rarely, if ever, stand the test of time. It seems to stir controversy when I talk about the fact that no matter how great social media is, it is not as effective for building strong bonds of trust as real human contact is. Social media fans will tell me about all the close friends they've made online. But if social media is the end-all be-all, then why do over 30,000 bloggers and podcasters descend on Las Vegas every year for a huge conference called Blog World? Why don't they just meet online? Because nothing can replace face-to-face meetings for social animals like us. A live concert is better than the DVD, and going to a ball game feels different than watching on TV, even though the view is better on television. We like to actually be around people who are like us. It makes us feel like we belong. It is also the reason a video conference can never replace a business trip. Trust is not formed through a screen. It is formed across a table. It takes a handshake to bind humans. And no technology yet can replace that. There is no such thing as virtual trust. On the website for NMX, the official name of the Blog World event, there's a promotional video in which people talk about what's so great about going to the event. Sharing ideas is a frequent advantage discussed. Getting to meet so many different people, bringing everyone together, and meeting people who do what I do, who are on the same journey. These are also frequent themes. And of course, my personal favorite, said by someone who follows many of the bloggers who attend the conference, I got to shake their hands, and that was awesome. Even bloggers have to appreciate the irony of bringing together the champions of the blogosphere to meet in person to share ideas about the supremacy of the blogosphere. Real, live, human interaction is how we feel a part of something, develop trust, and have the capacity to feel for others. It is how we innovate. It is why telecommuters never really feel like they're part of the team as strongly as the ones who go to work every day. No matter how many emails they send or receive, no matter how kept in the loop they are, they're missing all the social times, the gaps, the nuance, the humanity of being around other humans. But what do we do in hard times when we need good ideas most? We cut back on conferences and business trips because video conferencing and webinars are cheaper. Perhaps, but only in the short term. Given how relatively new social media is, the long-term impact of all this dehumanizing is still yet to be fully realized. Just as we are feeling the impact today of the policies and practices implemented in the 1980s and 1990s that prioritized profit over people, we will have to wait a generation before we feel the full effects of our modern bias to replace real interaction with virtual ones. Rule 2. Keep it manageable. Obey Dunbar's number. In 1958, Bill Gore quit his job at DuPont to pursue his belief in the possibilities of the polymer polytetrafluoroethylene, or PTFE, commonly known as Teflon. That same year, he and his wife, Vive, started W.L. Gore & Associates in their basement. It was a friendly place, and everyone knew everyone else. But the discovery of a new polymer, expanded polytetrafluoroethylene, EPTFE, by their son Bob, changed the course of Bill and Vive's company forever. EPTFE, or Gore-Tex, as it's more commonly known, had nearly infinite applications in medical, fabric, and industrial markets. It was only a matter of time before the humble, family-oriented company outgrew its basement headquarters and moved into a factory. Business was booming and demand grew. So did the factory, and the number of people in its employ. As the story goes, one day Bill Gore walked out onto the floor of his factory and realized he didn't recognize many of the people. Things had gotten so big that he simply did not know who was working for him anymore. Something told him that this couldn't be good for him, his employees, or the company. After doing some counting, Gore concluded that to maintain the sense of camaraderie and teamwork he felt was essential for the factory to run smoothly, it should have only about 150 people. That was the magic number. Instead of trying to eke out more efficiencies by increasing the size of the existing factory, Gore would simply build an entirely new factory, sometimes right next door to an old one. Each factory was capped at 150 people. It turned out Bill Gore was onto something. Business continued to boom under this model, and, as important, the relationships among the employees stayed strong and cooperative. Today, the still privately held company has sales of $3.2 billion per year and employs more than 10,000 people around the world, and it still attempts to organize its plants and offices in working groups of about 150. Though Bill Gore was trusting his gut based on his own observations, it's no coincidence that he arrived at the 150-person limit. Ruben Dunbar, British anthropologist and a professor in the Department of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University, arrived at this same conclusion. Professor Dunbar figured out that people simply cannot maintain more than about 150 close relationships. Putting it another way, he likes to say, it's the number of people you would not feel embarrassed about joining uninvited for a drink if you happened to bump into them in a bar. The earliest groups of Homo sapiens lived in hunter-gatherer tribes that maxed out between 100 to 150 people. Amish and Hutterite communities are about 150 in size. The Bushmen of South Africa and Native Americans also live in groups that cap out at about 150. Even the size of a company of Marines is about 150 people. That magical number is the number of close relationships we are naturally designed to manage. Any more than that starts to cause a breakdown if rigid social systems or effective hierarchy and bureaucracy are not implemented to help manage the scale. This is the reason senior leaders must trust mid-level leaders, because no one person can effectively manage large numbers of people if there is to be a strong sense of trust and cooperation. The reasons groups function best when they do not get bigger than about 150 people make perfect sense when you look closely. The first reason is time. Time is a constant. There are only 24 hours in a day. If we only gave 2 minutes to everyone we knew, we wouldn't get to know people very well, and deep bonds of trust would likely never form. The other is brain capacity. We simply can't remember everyone. which is why Dunbar's number is about 150. Some can remember more and some remember fewer. In addition, as Dunbar has noticed in his research, when groups get bigger than about 150, the people are less likely to work hard and less likely to help each other out. This is a pretty significant finding, as so many businesses work to manage their growth by focusing on cost efficiencies but ignore the efficiencies of human relationships. And ultimately, it is the strength of those human relationships that will help an organization manage at scale. Many people thought that with the introduction of the internet, Dunbar's number would be rendered obsolete. The ability to communicate with large numbers of people would become more efficient, giving us the capacity to maintain more relationships. It turns out not to be the case. Our anthropology wins again. Even though you may have 800 friends on Facebook, odds are high that you don't personally know them all, and they may not all personally know you. If you were to sit down and try to contact all of them directly, as the journalist Rick Lax wrote about in Wired.com, you would very quickly learn that Dunbar's number wins. Lax was surprised how few of his 2,000 friends he actually knew or who actually knew him. In small organizations, where we are able to know everyone, it is much easier for us to do the work necessary to look after them. We are, for all the obvious reasons, more likely to look after people we personally know than those we don't. If a person on a factory floor knows who the accountant is, and the accountant knows who the machinists are, they are more likely to help each other. When a leader is able to personally know everyone in the group, the responsibility for their care becomes personal. The leader starts to see those for whom they are responsible as if they were their own family. Likewise, those in the group start to express ownership of their leader. In a Marine platoon of about 40 people, for example, they will often refer to the officer as our lieutenant, whereas the more distant and less seen senior officer is simply the colonel. When this sense of mutual ownership between leader and those being led starts to break down, when informality is replaced by formality, it is a sure sign that the group may be getting too big to lead effectively. This means, for larger organizations, the only way to manage the scale and keep the circle of safety strong is to rely on hierarchies. A CEO can care about their people in the abstract, but not until the abstraction is mitigated can the care be real. The only way to truly manage at scale is to empower the levels of management. They can no longer be seen as managers who handle or control people. Instead, managers must become leaders in their own right, which means they must take responsibility for the care and protection of those in their charge, confident that their leaders will take care of them. Professor Dunbar learned that in bigger companies, ones with many hundreds or thousands of employees who are not distributed into groups of fewer than 150, employees tend to have more friends outside of their job than inside. The larger the group of people we work with, the less likely we are to develop any kind of trusting relationships with them. I had the opportunity to take a tour of the old offices of a large social media company in Northern California. I can't say which one, because the company requires that every visitor sign a restrictive non-disclosure agreement before they let them in the building. The office was a large, loft-like open space with rows of people working together. The goal of the open space was to encourage open communication and a cross-pollination of ideas. The manager giving the tour made a comment that I found interesting, given Dunbar's own findings. This company grew in part because of a culture of amazing cooperation, sharing, and open communication, he told me. The company believed it was because of the open plan layout, and so, as the company grew, they kept that same layout, the one that I was being shown. But for reasons they couldn't quite explain, cooperation and open communication did not improve as the company grew. In fact, as my tour guide admitted, it got worse. Dunbar wins again. Rule 3. Meet the people you help. In 2010, Adam Grant, a management professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, set out to study the effectiveness of his college's fundraising department and to understand what worked and what didn't. The job was straightforward. Employees called on alumni and tried to persuade them to donate money to a scholarship fund for exceptional students whose families couldn't afford to pay for college. The fundraisers were instructed to describe the university's dire financial position and the impressive accomplishments of the prospective recipients. The alumni would hear about the university's need to increase its investment in computer science, say, or business administration to help create the next generation of leaders. This was, after all, the future workforce of the new economy, the callers would tell them. By all accounts, the pitch was pretty inspiring. Yet, as hard as they would try, fundraisers were having only moderate success. Their numbers didn't improve even with an arsenal of research about the sting of the recession on university budgets. Furthermore, the job had all the characteristics of any mundane work: repetitive tasks, long hours sitting still, and occasionally rude customers. Needless to say, turnover in the fundraising department was extraordinarily high, leading to even worse morale. So Grant came up with an idea to improve the effectiveness of the fundraisers, and it only took 5 minutes. Professor Grant arranged for students who received the scholarships to come to the office and spend 5 minutes describing to the fundraisers how the scholarship they received changed their lives. The students told them how much they appreciated the hard work of the fundraising department. Even though the people impacted by the work of the fundraisers were only there for a short time, the results were astounding. In the following month, the fundraisers increased their average weekly revenue by more than 400%. In a separate similar study, callers showed an average increase of 142% in the amount of time they spent on the phone and 171% increase in the amount of funds they raised. As social animals, it is imperative for us to see the actual, tangible impact of our time and effort, for all our work to have meaning and for us to be motivated to do even better. The logic seems to follow Milgram's findings, except in this case it's positive. When we are able to physically see the positive impact of the decisions we make or the work we do, not only do we feel that our work has worth, but it also inspires us to work harder and do more. A control group that had not received a visit from a student showed no improvement in sales or time spent on the phone. A third group that simply listened to a manager describe how much a scholarship meant to a student also showed no increase in performance. In other words, our bosses telling us how important our work is nowhere near as powerful as us getting to see it ourselves. The loan department of a Wells Fargo bank had a similar experience. When they invited a customer to come into the bank and describe how a loan had changed their life, how it allowed them to buy a house or pay off a debt, it had a dramatic effect on the motivation of bank employees to help more people do the same. They could see for themselves the impact their work was having in someone's life. This is a significant shift in how the employees perceive their jobs, and it is foundational to having a sense of purpose in the work we do. Without necessarily being aware of it, many of the employees stopped coming to work to sell loans and started coming to work to help people. Further proof of how much the quality of our work improves when we can attach a human being to the results was seen in a study that found that simply showing radiologists a photograph of a patient led to a dramatic improvement in the accuracy of their diagnostic findings. Adam Grant conducted another study on lifeguards at a community recreation center. One group of lifeguards was given reading material of testimonies from other lifeguards about how their work helped them advance their personal goals. A second group was given materials to read of first-hand accounts of lifeguards who had actually saved the lives of swimmers. Those who read about the lifeguards saving people's lives were far more motivated at work and devoted more time to helping swimmers than those who read about how the job could help them personally. Many of us would say we're not surprised by these findings. After all, it seems rather obvious. Or does it? Grant surveyed several thousand executives to find out how important it was to them that they feel their work has value. The results? Only 1% of the executives said managers should bother showing employees that their work makes a difference. If anything, many companies try to explain the value our work will have in our own lives, the benefits we will reap if we hit a goal, as opposed to the benefit that others will derive. But remember our biology. We are naturally cooperative animals that are biologically more inspired and motivated when we know we're helping others. This is one of the reasons I love the organization Charity Water. If you give them a donation, which you can do at charitywater.org, besides the fact that 100% of that donation goes to the cause that they are championing, to bring clean drinking water to the 700 million people who don't have it, they will actually send you a photograph and GPS coordinates of the well your money paid for. Though going to Africa and meeting people yourself is even better, it is quite powerful to see the actual result of the donation you give. Most of us, unfortunately, will never see the people whose lives our work touches. For the vast majority, the closest we come to seeing results is evaluating numbers on a spreadsheet or reading about what customers like in a report. If the line on the graph goes up, we're told we've done well and we should feel proud of what we've accomplished. We are expected to feel something for the numbers and think about the people. Our want to invest more time and energy is, however, biologically tied to the opposite, to feel for the people and think about the numbers. It makes sense for social animals that our sense of purpose is always human. Rule 4. Give them time, not just money. Let's say you're moving to a new house. To help you out, one of your friends pays for the moving company, a very generous offer worth $5,000. Another friend comes to your house and helps you pack the boxes, load the truck, travel with you to the new house, unload and unpack the boxes. 2 weeks later, both friends need a favor from you on the same day. Which would you feel more inclined to help? The one who wrote a check or the one who committed time and energy? Money is an abstraction of tangible resources or of human effort. It is a promissory note for future goods or services. Unlike the time and effort that people spend on something, it is what money represents that gives it its value. And as an abstraction, it has no real value to our primitive brains, which judge the real value of food and shelter and the behavior of others against the level of protection or safety they can offer us. Someone who gives us a lot of money, as our brains would interpret their behavior, is not necessarily as valuable to our protection as someone willing to commit their time and energy to us. Given our obsessive need to feel safe among those in our tribe, our communities, and our companies, we inherently put a premium value on those who give us their time and energy. Whereas money has a relative value, $100 to a college student is a lot, $100 to a millionaire is a little, time and effort have an absolute value. No matter how rich or poor someone is, or where or when they were born, we all have 24 hours in a day and 365 days in a year. If someone is willing to give us something of which they have a fixed and finite amount, a completely non-redeemable commodity, we perceive greater value. If we waste money, we can make more, especially in our society. But we've all had the experience of sitting in a meeting or watching a movie, or maybe even listening to this book, and thinking to ourselves, I will never get this time back. You can save time if you stop listening now, but I cannot give you back the time you've already spent to get here. Sorry. And it's not just time. The energy we give also matters. If a parent goes to watch their kid's soccer game, but only looks up from their mobile device when there's cheering, they may be giving their time, but they haven't given their energy. The kid will look over to see their parents head down most of the game, busy texting or emailing the office or something. Regardless of the intentions of that parent, without giving their attention, the time is basically wasted for both parent and child. The same is true in our offices when we talk to someone while reading our emails or sit in a meeting with one eye on our phone. We may be hearing all that is said, but the person speaking will not feel we are listening, and an opportunity to build trust or be seen as a leader who cares is squandered. Just as a parent can't buy the love of their children with gifts, a company can't buy the loyalty of their employees with salaries and bonuses. What produces loyalty, that irrational willingness to commit to the organization even when offered more money elsewhere, is the feeling that the leaders of the company would be willing, when it matters, to sacrifice their time and energy to help us. We will judge a boss who spends time after hours to help us as more valuable than a boss who simply gives us a bonus when we hit a target. If a colleague told you that over the weekend they gave $500 to charity, what would you think of them? We'd think they were nice, but we would probably wonder why they were telling us. Did they want a medal or something? If another colleague told us that over the weekend they volunteered their time to paint a school in the inner city, what would you think of them? That's cool, we'd think to ourselves. I should do more. Simply hearing about the time and energy someone gave to others can inspire us to want to do more for others too. Remember your oxytocin. Though we may get a shot of chemical feel-good from the money we give, it doesn't last long, and it isn't likely to affect how others view us. Someone participating in a walkathon finds it personally fulfilling and does more to raise their status than the one who simply donated to their effort. Giving time and energy actually does more to impact the impression others have of us than giving money. This is the reason a CEO with a bad reputation can't redeem themselves by writing checks to charity. That's not behavior we view as valuable to the tribe. It is also the reason we are more tolerant of the missteps or occasional bad decisions made by a CEO whom we believe to be genuinely committed to the protection of their people. A leader of an organization can't simply pay their managers to look out for those in their report. A leader can, however, offer their time and energy to those in their care, and in turn, those managers would be more willing to give their time and energy to their subordinates. Then their subordinates would, in turn, be more inclined to give their time and energy to their direct reports. And at the end of the chain, the people with the outward-facing jobs are more likely to treat the customer better. It's just biology. The oxytocin and serotonin make us feel good when time and energy are given to us, which inspires us to give more of ourselves to others. Business is a human enterprise. It may even be why we call a business a company, because it's a collection of people in the company of other people. It's the company that matters. Rule 5. Be patient. The rule of 7 days and 7 years. I went on a first date with a woman recently. It was an amazing first date. We spent nearly 8 hours together. We went for brunch, strolled around the city. We went to a museum and then for dinner. We talked and talked the whole time. We were both smiling, giggling. We even started holding hands a few hours in. As a result of that amazing first date, we've decided to get married. Needless to say, we're both very excited. You flinched a bit when you heard that last bit, didn't you? It's normal when we hear stories like that. Our immediate reaction is, that's crazy. But you weren't on my date with me. We're in love, I swear. The fact is, we instinctively know that the strong bond of human trust cannot be formed after one date, or even after 1 week. In contrast, if I told you I've been dating the same woman for 7 years and we're not married yet, you might think, what's wrong then? The strong positive feeling we may have after a great first date, or even a great job interview, is not love or trust. It's a predominantly dopamine-fueled feeling telling us that we think we found what we're looking for. Because it feels good, we can sometimes mislabel it as something more stable than it is, even if both parties feel it. This helps us explain how the love-at-first-date may crumble soon after. It also helps us understand why someone we loved in an interview, a few months into the job, doesn't turn out to be a good fit for the organization. It's because we didn't actually spend time enough to get to know if we can indeed rely on the person. Jumping straight in, even if it feels right, is nothing short of gambling. It may work out, but the odds are against you. It is just as bad if we stay too long without ever feeling like we belong. If we've been at a job for 7 years and still don't feel it, well, maybe it's time to move on. Our internal systems are trying to help us navigate the social world so that we can find people who may be more willing to give of themselves to help us and be part of our circle of safety. It takes time to get to know someone and build the trust required to sustain a relationship, personal or professional. Our world is one of impatience, a world of instant gratification, a world ruled by dopamine. Google can give us the answer we want now. We can buy online and get what we want now. We can send and receive information instantaneously. We don't have to wait a week to see our favorite show. We can watch it now. We've gotten used to getting what we want when we want it. This is all fine and good for movies or online shopping. But it's not very helpful when we're trying to form the bonds of trust that can withstand storms. It takes time, and there's no app that can speed that up. I have no data to say exactly how long it takes to feel like we trust someone. I know it takes more than 7 days, and I know it takes fewer than 7 years. I know it is quicker for some and slower for others. No one knows exactly how long it takes, but it takes patience.